Hello, this is Paul Jackson on Jazz FM.
Hello, Paul. It is amazing to see you here.
I'm having a great time.
Let me just say, first of all, you've come in here with a cane that is the most, one of the most magnificent canes I've ever seen. What is that, a rattlesnake, a cobra?
No, it's a cobra.
A cane in the, in the shape of the cobra. Is that something special to you, or did you just like it?
Well, it's special to me in the sense that, I hope my music bites you, too.
It's been doing that for decades.
Well, this time you're not going to recover.
Yeah. Well, it's sweet poison, let's put it that way.
That's right.
We've been listening to your rhythmic bass lines for so long, and they're ingrained in the psyche, for me anyway. Would you consider yourself more of a funk artist than a jazz artist, or just a musician?
Oh, that's really far out. I've never asked that. Well, no. I've always tried to consider myself a musician. And without genre issues.
Yeah.
Since I started as a classical player. You know, so I played bassoon, which kept me from going to Vietnam. And, you know, it was a wonderful thing. There's only two bassoon players in the Army at the time. So, and then I played also my upright bass. And, stationed in Berlin, I had a organ trio. And I was playing Jimmy Smith blues music and doing all the other little jazz, standard jazz songs on the upright.
Was there ever the threat that you might have to go off to a conflict zone and fight, get your boots on?
As a bassoon player, that was one of the most calculated moves I've ever made in my life.
A very wise one indeed. Yeah. I was listening to Actual Proof on Herbie's Thrust album, I think it is, and it struck me that's possibly the greatest bass line ever. And it's you on the bass. There's something about it that really resonates with me. Those bass lines back then, I mean, they live on, don't they? They are themselves monsters that you created that live on.
It's really funny that you actually even bring that up, because I was talking to another bass player about the realization of actually hearing that line for myself the first time. Now, you know, we did that thing, I think we recorded it on my birthday, and it was like almost like the we were literally tired of playing it the way we had been trying to play it. And so I just turned around the mic and said, "Hey, listen, why don't we just do what we kind of normally do?" And we just wham, we did it. And the funny part is that I never really listened to it after that.
Really?
I have tapes of me playing in New York, it took me almost a year to relearn what I played on the record because I didn't hear it.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't listening to it the same way other people were. You know, it was just part of something I did and I was moving on.
It's a complex bass line, and I guess it was in the moment then. If you never listened to it again, you had to relearn it. That was literally something you did in the moment and left that lasting legacy with us. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, actually, music is like that, you know, and I hope that tomorrow's music is going to be the same.
When you were composing music back then, was it you and Mike Clark from the Headhunters that kind of started the groove and then Herbie would jump on, or did he give you a kind of sketch of what he wanted?
No, typically me and Mike had a group together, okay? And so the groove started, it was typically from the bass line, which is really, was good for me. And, you know, and I either listened to, sometimes we talk about it, or we play something that we used, and we play something that we were used for something else, completely out of context, you know, with Herbie, you know, and just try it in anyway.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, that's what it really is about. It's just always trying to play something different. That was one of the good things that I had so far as my particular job with Herbie's band, is that I did, you know, apart from the melody, the song, when it got to the solos, they had no idea what I was going to play, you know, because I would change the bass line.
I mean, what you guys did back then, you set the benchmark for grooves, I think, in Fusion, yourself and mm-hmm. Mike and Benny Maupin, of course, mm-hmm. and Bill, and Herbie came in. Have you ever heard of Chris Daddy Dave, the drummer?
No, I don't think so.
He's an American drummer, and he's probably, for me, one of the most exciting artists around at the moment. And he always opens up his set with a version of Actual Proof. And it just struck me that these young players, 19, 20, mid-20s, they're playing your bass lines, your grooves. And it struck me how lasting that is after 40 years that they've chosen to kind of keep that legacy going and take some of it for themselves.
Yes. That's, in fact, that's exactly what I try to teach. You know, because that's how I learned.
Yeah.
I learned from older musicians. Now, I was fortunate enough to be around that taught me how to play. And they taught me the right thing to play, you know, at the right time, the right notes with the right chord. And, you know, and a lot of musicians, the older musicians, don't take that time with some of the younger musicians anymore.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the reasons I still enjoy doing, like, these master classes I did on this series of tour. And it's one of the main things that I do in Japan.
Yeah. The most interesting thing for me was I was sitting at Ronnie Scott's watching Chris Dave and his group Drumheads, mm-hmm. and the bass player went into your groove. Mm-hmm. And the guy I brought with me, who's a seasoned musician who's been around for ages, he said to me, "Oh man, it sounds just like that guy in the Headhunters, Paul Jackson." And they were playing Actual Proof. I said, "You have no idea what you just said." I had to explain to him that was actually your groove that he was playing.
Yeah.
But there you go. So you had that style mm-hmm. that jumped out through somebody else. You gave that style to yeah. bass players.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, and the thing is, right now I'm trying to actually correct the bass players that do play it, so that they play it, so that actually they play it with the correct touch.
Yeah.
Because I find so many different things, and it's like. My particular style of playing electric bass is actually as a upright bass player playing electric bass, and since that encompasses the actual technique or the way I hold the instrument itself and play it,
yeah,
you know, almost in an upright type of position, you know, with my arms away, and then I don't play this, I don't play slap, I'm a straight finger picker. It's all different sound, you know, and so now I'm trying to teach people, like the younger bass players, that how important it is to actually have a balanced hands and the point of attack on the instrument in order to really get the sound that they think they want, you know, and then go on to develop their own thing from there.
Young bass players borrowing from Paul Jackson. Who did you admire and borrow a little bit from when you were coming up?
Oh, no question about it, Paul Chambers. I mean,
Mr. PC.
If I had never heard his bass, I probably would have never played. Yeah, but I mean, it was impressive for me at 9 years old to see him. It was impressive for me to see everybody at the old Black Hawk Club. That was Miles Davis.
You were in the Black Hawk, age 9.
Yeah.
Yeah. Took you there. They
used to have a kiddie corner.
A kiddie corner?
Yes. Parents could bring their kids and they'd have, you know, serve hot dogs and other stuff. And I'm in there and I'm watching Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, and J.J. Johnson, Roland Haynes. I'm 9 years old. And I'm seeing this guy, man, that has this beautiful, beautiful bass and it's got this baby face on it. You know, and I'm just listening to this thing. I go back to my school and I say, I want to try one of those.
Kiddie you know? Corner.
Oh.
Jazz club promoters, pay attention to this. This is how we get the young kids into jazz, into this music. They will be mesmerized by it. That's stunning. To think of you in the corner watching Paul Chambers.
Oh, listen, there's more to the story.
Yeah.
and if you don't mind me being completely honest, I mean, I did go back to my junior high school teacher, whatever. I said, "Give me a bass." And of course, you have to understand, I am 9 years old. Okay, I'm a kid, 9 years old.
Yeah.
I pick up a bass the very first time. The bass fits in between your legs. And you hit the E string, and it's like, whoa. Okay, I want to play this. You know, yeah. That, I mean, anything that feels that good, I got to play all the time.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm playing. I'm still playing.
Let's talk about, you are still playing, thank goodness for that. And what I was remarking on this morning, actually, when I was thinking about it, is that the Headhunters group, which I'm sorry to keep on about, but it's interesting that all of you guys are still playing, actually, and still alive and well and doing your thing in various guises.
Yeah.
You've got a new trio album out, Groove or Die. Interesting title.
Well, no, it's just, I mean, why should I give you a choice?
There's only one choice in that, isn't there?
That's right. You have only one. I'm giving you only one place to go.
And you've teamed up with some European musicians in Tony and in Zantane Black.
Yes.
Who I imagine, from knowing enough about him, knows instantly your music and fits nicely in, as well as is a great vocalist as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, like, I was just keep telling them, I said, well, actually, this is my son's. It's like my sons.
Yeah.
You know, so like...
Tony Match.
I have to think of him like that in one sense.
So you're dad on tour and stuff.
I'm the dad. I'm dad, yeah. And I got two twins. Can you believe that?
You've just come in from Austria. Are you busy on a European tour? Is it, you know, a lot of work out there for you?
We did. Just finished... where did we go? I forgot. And we just did a bunch of master... About 10 master classes in a row. So... from all around in Europe, and that was really wonderful. I really enjoy that. Yeah,
it's great to have you with a new album, and there is an American and British element involved in getting this album out there. The amazing Whirlwind Recordings with Michael Janosch, again another bass player.
Uh-huh.
Did you have a natural affinity because he's a bass player, and the album's come out on his label, of course? How do you guys work together? Is there a good rapport?
I'm working with him. I'm working with him, yeah, and I still have to give him a couple of lessons.
I'm sure that's why he's got you on the label, you know, actually. I mean, he said to me, come on, man, Paul Jackson, it's a no-brainer for me, you know.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, yeah, I'm going to help him in Japan, too, because I've been there. You know, what I'm going to do is actually now is start revealing what Paul Jackson has been doing for 30 years that has been unseen, but... has not been unseen. So, I mean, I have done so much in Japan, working even with the government. I had a program called Jazz for Kids. I went into all the schools. It was sponsored by the educational ministry, you know, and I've done with most of the top Japanese stars and jazz people there. I mean, while I was in Japan, I've played with Elvin Jones. I've played with all these other fantastic musicians that actually just came there, you know, and lived there. So, like, I have a lot of recording, a lot of video, a lot of things that actually I'm trying to pull the whole archives together and put it out slowly, you know. So that's you'll find out, like... there will be some recordings. In fact, I just found a very rare video, one of the only videos that I know of me playing a jazz job on upright bass.
A wealth of stuff to come. That's good news.
Oh, it's a lot of stuff to come.
Tell me about your relationship with Japan. It began many years ago, didn't it? How come you found a place to live there and you love it so much?
Well, the usual reason.
The misses.
The usual reasons.
And I mean, the cultural difference from you being learn that. On the West Coast.
You learn that anyway. You learn that anyway. Women will definitely do that to you. But yeah, the usual reasons.
And you still with the same lady?
Absolutely. I married her twice.
Just the second time, just to make sure.
Just to make sure.
Fantastic. I know you did some classic recordings with Herbie in Japan. Actually, there's a massive box set that came out here in the UK, about 34 Columbia albums, so an awful lot of your work in there as well. On the new album, you've re-explored one track in particular, "Tiptoe Through the Ghetto." Now, because I'm a bit of a collector, I know your album called Black Octopus, and it's super rare and so good.
Yeah, I mean, "Tiptoe Through the Ghetto" was particularly a challenge because that was one of the only albums that I completely utilized Geraldine, and everybody hears about the fabled bass Geraldine, and it is the instrument. I mean, you know, there's not very many it was the only place that I could actually use it. You know, this is an instrument that was designed to be my upright electric instrument. It has five outputs, one for every string. At one point in when we were playing with Herbie's, I actually carried four amplifiers, one amplifier for every string on this bass. you cannot duplicate the sound. You know, it's no tone control. There's nothing on it. You know, the bass sounds, it's built that way. Mr. Bartolini, before he died, made three pickups, and I was fortunate enough to get two of them, and they are distinctly four channel.
This is why you are the musician's musician, the bass player's bass player. See, they're making notes right now.
Yeah.
I've got four amplifiers, two double pickups.
Oh, this, but it's not only that, but this instrument itself was like, took a long time to make. It was, God bless his soul, the Japanese violin maker had a shop in Oakland. I think his son still carries on. It's, I forgot his first name, but Mr. Kamimoto. And son, he's a violin maker and now does guitars and stuff. But he actually helped that, and between him and Stars Guitars, which was you know, which is in San Francisco, they really helped me balance this instrument to make it what it is, you know. That's the story of Geraldine. It was very meticulously put together and planned, you know.
So. You haven't done things like Bootsy Collins does, where he puts his bass up front with the pilot when you fly and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, the thing is that like it's literally wherever you play on this instrument makes a difference. You know, it's like having, you know, if you go and buy a $50,000, $100,000. Upright bass, you want tone controls on it?
Yeah.
You don't know. If it doesn't sound good and you're paying that much money, you don't want it.
Indeed. The story of Tiptoe Through the Ghetto, which is a great title. I love that. Not the tulips, the ghetto.
Which one?
Yeah, which ghetto? What's the chart? Who do I have to speak to get that Black Octopus album put out again? Because it is just one of the best bits of work you ever did.
Oh, it's going to be reissued. Actually.
Oh,
yeah, it's good.
Music to my ears, literally.
Yeah, it's going to be reissued, and also an album that didn't really get. Would probably be coming out also. Republishing is Funk on a Stick, which I did entirely myself.
And the new album, is it a collaborative writing project, or did you have all this material ready to go and the guys kicked in on it?
The truth is, they found me. And then after they found me, I found them, you know, and it was, it's a very interesting situation, you know, I have to really, I really owe this band to the Live Music Agency and Maurizio, because he had the idea. And, actually I think he is enough of a visionary to actually hear, Zontané, and actually, and he knew Tony. Now we never met, but I knew of him mainly just simply because he's just a lock in a pocket groove player, you know.
Lock it in the pocket.
Oh yeah.
See, I knew you're a funk man at heart.
That's right. Oh yeah, for sure. That's it. That's it. But you know, it does more. You know.
Hypothetically, if I win the Euro Millions lottery. And I'm suddenly £114 million better off.
Mm-hmm.
If I call you and I say, "Listen, Paul, I'm going to give you some money, and I want Blackbird McKnight, Mike Clark, Benny, and Bill Summers. I want you all together to do a gig for me. Would you do it?
I would do it.
Diplomatic answer.
I would do it, but right. I see. I can only answer for myself.
This is very true. But yeah. I've got one out of five, so that's all good.
Yeah. So I mean, you have one solid option.
Yeah.
You know, at least you know Paul Jackson will take the gig.
Good. Right. That's one down. Four to okay. go. What a pleasure talking to Paul Jackson, bass player extraordinaire, and the album Groove or Die is out. And of course, you're going to be opening for the London Jazz Festival down at Hideaway in Streatham.
Yeah.
Did you know the London Jazz Festival is the biggest music event in London?
I mean, they have a choice.
Yeah.
Groove or Die, because I'm going to try to kill them.
Murder! On that note, thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.